Charlie Kirk isn't a person, right? He's a brand with a team. And on his own, he's a community college dropout who evangelizes at 18-year-olds.
Women with kids are not the ones tearing down statues, right?
Does tearing down statues correspond to some kind of smiles per capita data set that I wasn't aware of?
I mean,
of?
Again, it's like...
I am a competitive debater by trade. So the Cambridge Union isn't something that hosts highbrow intellectuals, because otherwise Charlie Kirk wouldn't be there.
Have you spoken at the Cambridge Union?
I have.
Yeah. So you just proved Tilly's point. Yeah.
Yeah. And to be fair, I love the debate.
How Islam mistreats women, we could talk all day long. Like, I'm all for that.
I was like, yes. Fine, like, sure. Like, I didn't even mention Islam.
What he's doing here is he's trying to change the topic.
I think I did feel a bit of an imposter syndrome.
Who cares if you deserve it? You got it. Like, it's yours.
The women of the West are miserable, and they're miserable for a reason.
More and more Gen Z women are trying to date millennial men. This is total, like, aestheticization of sexual extremes.
Single Christian country that you would say mistreats women, right?
America. The Reform Party is a serious threat to democracy in the United Kingdom.
The fight back is against oligarchy and authoritarianism.
Would you say you are still, like, a Labour supporter?
The left is incapable of compartmentalisation. And I'm going to stand my ground on this one, actually.
Coming from a working class background, onto one of the best universities in the world.
Cooked Charlie Kirk.
Where do you put yourself?
What's left? Back in the stew with the slayer of the far-right American populace. Are you dumb? Tilly, welcome to What's Left. Our first ever woman on the show. Is this your first podcast appearance, or have you done stuff like this before?
No, it's my first podcast. Actually, I did an interview with GQ. Like a couple of days ago.
You did an interview with GQ.
Did you really? Yeah. It was like over the phone. Right. But yeah.
So they're doing that. They're doing a profile piece on you.
I think me and the other people who debated Charlie Kirk, they're going to write something about debating chambers and take that kind of angle on it.
I love that.
But well, yeah.
You loved your GQ interview.
Yeah, to be fair, I was pretty gassed.
Did you see his GQ? The headline was like, it was so funny. So anytime I invite like a guest onto the show, I send them like a link to like my work, and then I have to put Javan's stuff in and it looks way better. But his was like the man taking on Nigel Farage with Windrush generation style. Wow. And it's like,
I'm literally at 1950s clothing. Brother, still the most stylish
I was like, I thought I had good drip. But yeah. Yeah. I mean, so... That must be all mad. Like, can you just talk us through the full story of the like how you got into doing this debate, how you felt it went in the moment, and the reaction since?
I am a competitive debater by trade, so I've done a lot of formalised debates. I did it through, I self-taught debate and then paid for a debate coach with a school bursary back in high school. And so, obviously, wow. I was interested in the Cambridge Union when I initially got to university. I'd made one speech before at the Union.
What was that speech on?
Yeah, it was this house welcomes the decline of America. And I spoke on properly.
Woo!
Yeah. Oh, you did? Yeah. And that was, that went a little bit. That got a couple hundred thousand views. And obviously I was really excited about that. So I had about 5,000 followers. Wow. And I was making a few videos on politics. The Union makes an Instagram post that Charlie Kirk is coming in. Everyone's very upset about it. Not me. They say fill out a form. With what kind of question you might want to ask him, you'd be given the right of reply. So I wrote my question into the form, which was, what should the role of women kind of look like in public and private life, and what are the material benefits of that?
Yeah.
I knew that he wouldn't answer that question, which is why I wrote it. I checked my emails like maybe 12 hours before the debate and said, oh, well, you've been chosen to debate him. Played a few of his Turning Point USA clips and thought, well, you know, what kind of things might he throw at the debate? And made a few notes on my phone. And
did you feel? Because like this is quite a big guy with a following, and he's got a particular debating style. I know how I would feel if I was selected to debate against him.
Slightly shook.
Oh yeah. I would be a bit stressed out.
You've got balls of steel. Like low-key, yeah. I would be stressed going into that.
Not particularly. I mean, I've debated some of the most intelligent people in the world and lost horrendously in the past in front of, you know, quite a few people. I've debated Team Canada, national debating team in high school, and Team USA, Team Singapore, Team Hong Kong. These people are much more intelligent than Charlie Kirk. I feel like he's a bit of a snake oil salesman, right?
Yeah.
Like, there was this one video that I saw in particular of him that just, I didn't understand why people would be intimidated. It was, he was speaking on John Locke, and he said something about, you know, liberty is not license. That doesn't actually mean anything, because I've studied John Locke in the context of John Locke's philosophy. You're not applying that correctly, because he was
so
applying it to abortion.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, he's never said anything about abortion. That's like bullshit. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. So that's why I wasn't particularly intimidated going in, because I've debated people who are debaters, and Charlie Kirk isn't that. He's someone who is selling a program. Mm. He's selling an idea, a bad idea, that has unfortunately metastasized in American politics.
Charlie Kirk is so popular. Yeah. Why do you think that has happened?
Because it's simple. It's great PR backing. So much, obviously so much money goes into these kind of things. Charlie Kirk isn't a person, right? He's a brand with a team. And on his own, he's a community college dropout who evangelizes at 18-year-olds. And that's not exactly something that you'd imagine would be this like slick, cool, subversive brand. This is something that's fundamentally American, to the point where it's probably a bit hilarious for Europeans who watch it and then see people like him believing that they are some kind of reactionary and subversive figure, when this has been like the cornerstone of the US, right? Yeah. Since the 1950s.
And Turning Point USA, they captured this idea, I think, that institutions like universities have become like quite left-wing or very leftist in some of their agenda, and there's obviously space then for some form of like reactionary politics. And it's interesting what you said earlier about when they were invited him to the Cambridge Union, loads of Cambridge students were really upset, and I think that's a bit sad. It's like Cambridge is our brightest and our best. Why are we upset that someone like that, who has a massive profile, is obviously going to be platformed, is coming? That's your opportunity to challenge that person.
You play into their point and their argument, which is part of the problem.
Like, we're just going to deplatform them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I remember when Turning Point was kind of first kind of kicking off, about 2015, 2016. And it was something that was just a bit fringe, a bit kind of on the side of kind of trying to make the university space a lot more kind of hostile for maybe progressive students or whatever else. And then all of a sudden it just seemed to just grow overnight, where it just had resource, funding, people attached to it. And they were just like touring around UK universities, and now I guess they have some following. But with all of that in mind, how did you feel about the fact that Cambridge students were, to a point, being a bit hostile about him? Do you think it kind of leans into maybe how they get some legitimacy around their argument? I mean,
so on the one hand, I 100% understand why people would be upset about someone like Charlie Kirk entering what they understand as this like hallowed ground. For me, the Cambridge Union isn't that. The Cambridge Union isn't something that hosts highbrow intellectuals, because otherwise Charlie Kirk wouldn't be there, right? it's a place where, I mean, the Wizard Liz was just at the Oxford Union. It's not, you know...
Have you spoken at the Cambridge Union?
I have.
Yeah,
I have.
So you just proved to the point. Yeah.
And to be fair, I lost the debate.
sorry, you were saying.
You know, what I mean is that if the Cambridge Union was somewhere like that, I'd understand the frustration, because then you are legitimizing a bad idea. You're legitimizing something that is corrosive to social well-being, corrosive to democratic ideals. But that's not what it looks like. It's somewhere that, you know, it's where free speech has the opportunity, like to look great. It's a great context for free speech. Like in the street, you know, in the middle of London, people shouting at each other, it's not the best context for free speech. And I understand why people might want to put guardrails on it in the interest of safety and other things. But in a debating chamber, that's, you know, that's the opportunity, like you say, to challenge people who have bad ideas.
I do think that is one of the brilliance of the kind of Oxford unions, through their kind of bourgeois pomp. It is like one of the few, I believe in this kind of society, last remaining institutions that you can entertain this kind of conversation, and you can beat down what are quite ridiculous ideas and show sophistication and intellect in the face of kind of provocation and amateur debating style, which is what I would argue you went up against.
It's an amateur debate, yeah.
You know what's interesting as well is that Malcolm X, for instance, would have had in the 1960s going to the Oxford Union protests about him being involved, right? And I'm not necessarily a Malcolm X-er, but like he was a really important part of the political dynamism of that whole era. And that's the point of the free speech argument, is that some people are going to say things that you don't like sometimes, but the good argument, the strong argument, should win out. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of what you had happen, right? Like you gave it to him and he couldn't pivot. He didn't have a good response. And it was probably one of the first times his shield had been pierced, like, properly.
I mean, I don't know about that. I don't talk myself up to that extent. But I appreciate you for doing it.
Well, like, honestly, you should like take a lot of good grace from it, because clearly you've captured something that plenty of other commentators who've come up against him, who are university students, weren't able to do when he was turning up on college campuses, right? So, you know, how has that been? You've got overnight hundreds of thousands of followers on TikTok. You've probably gone from being like a bit of a BNOC to, you know, people...
I was
kinda,
not a BNOC.
Really? Well, now, well, big leave on campus now, though. People must stop you all the time and talk to you. But that's also a bit weird and kind of like where's my privacy sort of vibes. Yeah. How have you found that so far?
So, that's interesting that you would take the assumption that I was someone who was ever had
competitive any kind debater. Of right?
Yeah, competitive debaters are like nerds. No one knows them. Right. Like, well, that's my experience anyway. But yeah, I was someone with a very small circle. Didn't particularly get out much, especially in first year. Second year was my social year. And by that, I mean going to society events and networking with people. Like, I'm very much just interested in my degree and going to school and coming home. Overnight, things changed a lot. I was invited to all kinds of events. People were very interested in me and the things that I had to say. In a way, it felt sort of superficial, but I did understand why.
Is Cambridge this hyped space special place for, you know, intellectuals, or is it just like another place?
I mean, Cambridge students are just people. Yeah. At the end of the day, when I got into Cambridge, I was incredibly excited because I was like, oh, everyone's, you know, I'm going to be the idiot in the room. Yeah, I think you do have to readjust your expectations for Cambridge once you go, because I got into Cambridge and I'd attended a residential there before. I got on like one of those free residentials for state school students. Before that, I'd read stories of, you know, poets and authors who'd been to Cambridge, and they speak about how beautiful it is. And obviously, it is all of those things. It's beautiful and it's wonderful. But at the same time, it's still an academic institution. And what I learned through going to Cambridge was that, first of all, you can't get away with bullshit. It's not something that you can't sit in a supervision and say a bunch of flowery things. Yeah. And then expect to get some point. You know, I read The Secret History by Donna Tartt, and I was like, that's going to be Cambridge. Mm. When I was about 16, I was like, that's going to be my Cambridge experience. I'm going to sit around a fireplace with an old professor, and we're going to say a bunch of nonsense about,
that's
you know,
exactly
yeah, Greek, yeah, Greek tragedy and love and all this stuff. And it wasn't. It's immensely academic, and I had to strip back all of the pretense. I was quite obsessed with aesthetics for a while, like when I was like younger, and I read Nietzsche. I was that kind of 16-year-old, super popular in high school, obviously. And then getting into Cambridge, I stripped all that back, and I realized what's important.
So, did you ever have an experience of imposter syndrome then?
No,
really,
I don't have that. Yeah. Like, I never understand why people necessarily do. I mean, there was a brief moment where I spoke to one of my very close friends, and he went to Sevenoaks, and now he's transferring.
So that's a private school.
It is. It's like £54,000 a year or something like that. Right. He was on my debate team, and we became really close friends. I wrote his personal letter of recommendation for Dartmouth, and I did speak to him briefly. I was like, but I don't know if I deserve this. And he was like, who cares if you deserve it? You got it. Like, it's yours. Do you think that I'm asking myself, do I deserve to be at this institution? I was like, well, no, you're probably not. So why should I?
I just draw quickly on my experience where I think I did feel a bit of an imposter syndrome because it was so far removed from my Middle England background where nobody had really gone to like independent schools. It wasn't like a vibrant intellectual culture. There was a culture around like class and solidarity, of course, that I think shaped a lot of my politics, but there wasn't like an intellectual, like an active intellectual culture in the area that I grew up. And then going to Cambridge and then seeing, to a point, the sophistication, but also embodied everything that I think I despise about kind of the British class system. Because to a point, you go there and you're baptised into the middle classes or the upper middle classes or whatever it is. So you have this cultural approximation to it. And I think it does shape you as a human being, but it doesn't take away from the fact that I still think it's so reprehensible because so few people get to go who are incredibly intelligent. And for me, at least, I saw people who I grew up with who have that intelligence. And we were talking about this with Matt Talbot a couple of weeks ago, where some of the most brilliant people
Don't have opportunity.
They just don't have the chance. Yeah. And that's it. And like, talent is absolutely evenly distributed in this country, and yet access most definitely isn't.
Yeah.
And so I just saw people who, of course, some of the most incredibly intelligent people, I do believe, go there. But also at the same time, some of the most mediocre people also.
See, I saw that. Yeah. I saw it from the opposite side of the ledger, because I went to a private school and my parents are teachers. I kind of backdoored it. But I saw people who were just had every opportunity given to them and then went to Oxbridge because they could afford a tutor that was super expensive. I had a friend who literally stopped going to school in final year of school just to prepare to go to Oxford with like a private tutor.
Mm-hmm.
And he got in.
Yeah.
And like, and it's just like no one else, obviously he might see this now and I'm at him directly, but you know what I mean? Normal people don't have that opportunity. And I think in some ways that did radicalize like my politics more towards, you know, trying to change the entry level for being able to achieve in our society. Yeah, like, is, and I think this is a kind of a deeper thing to talk about, really, about where aspiration lies anymore and what it's really like to be an aspirant. Can you really make it now, or is the game becoming increasingly stacked against it? You're from a working class background.
Yeah.
You've got to this. You're already, at, you know, not even start of your career yet. You're still a student, but you know, you've seen this, the way in which the kind of needle can be thread. How do you square that circle around aspiration?
Well, I don't see myself as a poster child of meritocracy. I'd probably start there.
Right.
I wrote the first ever, you know, academic essay, that was the truly academic essay that I wrote, was my EPQ in high school. And I wrote that on, it ended up being about genetics. It started with Margaret Thatcher. And I ended up speaking on how talent can grow in environments where it's actively suppressed by externalities. So what I found out about genetics, and this is a really crude and rudimentary understanding of it because I'm not a scientist, I do politics, right? But what I understand about genetics from a political science perspective, insofar as it's relevant here, is that genes aren't static, fixed, and immutable. Genes, depending on environmental factors, can literally switch on and off. And by the time you're about 2 or 3 years old in Britain, as a working class child, your vocabulary is like pretty much half that of someone who is comes from more affluence than you. Like, given that all of this is true, why is it that people are kind of obsessed with the idea of who is aspirational and who deserves to have made it when so many things are stacked against us? Mm-hmm. Not to be a total determinist about it, because obviously that's also a fatalistic understanding of the world, but I'm not going to sit here and say, well, you know, I got into Cambridge, I was on free school meals for 7 years, I did it, you can do it too. Like, at the end of the day, it's not helpful.
No.
And it doesn't catalyze change, it makes people feel hopeless.
So if you're not the poster child for British meritocracy, coming from a working class background, gone to one of the best universities in the world,
cooked Charlie Kirk.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Where do you put yourself?
Well, maybe we can start with, like, what does meritocracy mean? Meritocracy is a formula, right? It's hard work plus talent equals output. I've worked very hard. I think not as hard as others. Like, there are people, my mum was a cleaner. She had 3 jobs. My dad had 2 jobs. Both of them basically, they moved away from a town called St. Helens, which has the highest rates of suicide in the country. Wow. I think one of the lowest life expectancies at the time. They moved away and knocked on the door of an auntie and uncle who lived in Morecambe, which is a seaside town. So that's luck. If our auntie and uncle didn't live there, we would have nowhere to go, and I would have grown up in St. Helens. And then I wouldn't have got into a grammar school because there were no grammar schools around in St. Helens. It's a historical contingency.
Mm.
And my parents worked much harder than me, and it was to facilitate my the accolades that I would then gather. Like, I didn't do it on my own, and I hate when people tell me that it's so good that you came from nothing and managed to achieve so much, because
it's
I
so
came from everything. Like,
yeah,
I had
yeah.
this, like, a support system. I my parents had me when they were 19 years old, didn't know anything about, you know, like, academics at all. Like, they, but my mom ended up going back to university, like going to university when she was like 20 something, in her late 20s. And my dad went to university when he was in his late 20s as well. That environment that facilitated my love for academics and for school. Which is why I would never say, well, I'm a poster child of meritocracy, because I don't particularly represent every working class person at all.
Do you feel like you're also grating against identity politics in a way, like, that people have to be defined by their backgrounds, that they're not more than just that, and it's not more a more nuanced picture?
So I have about a million different accents depending on who I speak to, and it's so weird, like, because I've debated in the United States, and Americans did not understand a broad northern accent, especially when I'm speaking extremely fast to get a bunch of content out in a debate. So I speak with, like, this, like quasi-American intonation. Like, you saw it in my Kirk debate, I was like, better life, so that you can fucking understand what I was saying. Because it's like, that's what's important. I'll look like an idiot so that you can understand me.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I have an accent that I acquired from Cambridge, which is a little bit southern. And it softens the northern.
The Cambridge accent,
yeah, you can probably hear it, right? And obviously I have the accent of my parents who come from St. Helens, which sounds a bit like Liverpool. And I speak with them in an accent that's much more aligned with that. But online, I do come across in a certain way. And people will say, well, you don't know anything about the world. You're obviously this posh middle-class person. You're at Cambridge with rich parents who will fund your lifestyle. And obviously there's a bit of misogyny. You'll then get a rich husband who will fund your lifestyle. Yeah. And you don't have to do anything. You know, even if that were true, I think I still care about the important issues. And I'm still disseminating them in a way that I hope people can resonate with. Mm. I don't think that
your content first, isn't it?
Yes.
Substance first.
Yeah. Yes.
But do you find on the accent thing, it's interesting because like everyone code switches, right? Like, and I've got about 15 as well in a back pocket. But I was just interested from your perspective, Joanne, because from a Midlands to doing everything that you've done in politics and stuff like that, does it grate you if anyone ever asks you about your accent?
Oh, people, yeah, it really, all the time. I'm from a ethnic minority background in this country, so I speak like my dad sometimes. He's from Jamaica. And then I went to this university where they wouldn't really understand really any of the kind of colloquialisms that I speak in. And then it's also a case of being taken seriously, not just, as you say, a kind of on a point of debate or anything else. But I know that when I kind of go into a room, much like yourself, and you touched upon it in terms of maybe coming from a working class background, there are assumptions made about you before you even get the chance to open your mouth.
Yeah.
Talking about the aspiration point, I think this is where a lot of kind of code switching happens for working class people, for kind of ethnic people, ethnic minority communities in this country, where you can't be taken seriously as your authentic self. I think you can be authentic, there's no doubt about it, but to a point your authenticity is oftentimes compromised because in order for you to be in that place where you can be authentic, you've had to compromise on something about yourself to get in that room.
You get like a double sword though in it, because Gary Stevenson, part of his like allure is that he talks in a normal accent, like but then also then gets attacked for that by people on the right who then say, you're playing up to it, or it's like an exacerbated form of how you normally speak. You can't win, basically.
No, you can't at all.
Anywhere you go, people want to fit in. And that's just how it is. People want to feel comfortable in their surroundings, and they want to be taken with a level of seriousness in whatever circumstance they're in. And so people naturally adjust. I just want to be taken as an equal and as kind of someone who's got something to contribute.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's like you'll do things in order to achieve that, even if it means that cohorts of individuals
and
won't
everyone
necessarily
does
be happy
it. I mean, unless you're probably one of the most privileged people.
But I might even push back on that because I have, you know, many of my friends went to private schools, these types of things, and what I noticed is that they will co-opt slang from the working class, to you know this more than it.
Bruv, do you want me to chat? Bruv, do you want me to chat? I can chat right
and
now.
It's insufferable. I can't deal with it. Like, hey. Was taught how to like dap people up by someone who went to fucking Eton, and it was so infuriating because it's I should know how to do this. Yeah, like, why are you teaching me
culture vultures. The thing is that you. The top end private schools and people who've met these people will know it. There's like a group of them who will appropriate working class culture, mainly because working class culture is actually vibrant and
it's brilliant.
And so they understand that there is like cultural capital in it, and so they go on to use it. For me, I always found it really difficult because my mum's side is like Windrush generation, working class. My grandma came on a banana boat in the 50s. And my dad's side is like teacher, educational class, right? So I had one foot in and one foot out. So the way I talked to my cousin, I picked up the phone to him the other day, and he was literally like, bro, stop talking in that voice. And I was like, I've just been in my work, you know, posh voice for such a long time that I'd forgotten to even be able to just like switch it on like that when you pick up the phone. And you see it if you know your like family who are like Jamaican. Yeah. As soon as they're in the yard, everyone starts talking patois. And they'll open the door because someone's knocked the door. Hello, how are you? And so it's like written into.
And these people have the Queen's English when they're ready. I can
tell you that. Oh, of course.
Like the most sophisticated, proper English you'll ever hear. And then behind
closed doors they act like real bad man. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I guess that is the point, isn't it? That they don't really experience any real pushback to being someone who code switches for fun or, you know, how to look culturally cool or whatever. Yeah. Whereas in some real ways, we have to kind of deal with the harms of this. I used to get gaslit about my heritage all the time at school. Like, people say, you're not actually Jamaican. I've seen your daddy's white. It's like, okay. You know more about my heritage than me. Fair play. You know, do you know what I mean? And that stuff does put a bit of a chip on your shoulder, I think, about...
Well, I feel like I have the same thing. My dad's from Jamaica, but my dad's Indian. He's Jamaican Indian. So people would be like, what is this Indian guy speaking like a black guy who says he's from Jamaica?
Well, my grandma's
Chinese. And his surname's a Hindu. People have such like binarized views of people, and this is, I guess, what we're coming at. Like the kind of effort to approximate yourself to some resistance culture, but not accepting the nuance of how kind of working class cultures have manifested in this country. I think it's just so simplistic, and it's largely like you said, the kind of vulture cultures who want to, or the culture vultures who want to approximate themselves to something, but really have no idea as to how diverse and plural that community of people are, and so just see a very like one-sided thing of who.
Can I ask you, because you got a lot of stuff around when you were doing the Charlie Kirk debate about whether you're using ChatGPT or not, do you think that is that sexism, is it classism, where's that coming from in your view?
I don't think it's classism, because what I understand of Americans, they don't have the cultural nuance to understand class dynamics in the UK. I spoke to Hassan Piker ages ago. I went to the pub with him and a few of my union friends, because he came to the union, and he was talking about, you know, he's a leftist content creator overall. I would like pull him up on some aspects of his feminism, but overall he's like quite leftist content creator. But he was saying, you know, he was talking about gammons, he was talking about like geezers and all this stuff that he obviously...
No clue.
Yeah, and it's like, that's fine. You're not from here. That's fine. So I don't think it's classism, because so many of the people who were throwing those accusations were from the United States. And potentially a little bit of misogyny. But more than anything, I think it's just disbelief that in such an age of anti-intellectualism, where people who engage in politics in a bad faith way are at the forefront of political life, people genuinely don't believe that you can predict people's responses. They believe that this is like this lost art. I got so many comments that's like, there's no way she could have predicted what he was going to say. So what are you talking about? Like, obviously,
watch two videos.
Exactly, yeah. I watched his videos, and then I decided I could probably predict what he was going to say.
But I guess it's a combination of, outside of all the things you said, it's largely just stupidity, because we've lost that ability to be agile, quick thinking, and anticipate how kind of debating operates, really.
Yeah, I mean, I always did get kind of pulled up by my debate coach in the past for being a little bit too rigid, for predicting things and then reading off my notes based on what I'd predicted. Like, that's not necessarily, it's not the best trait to have in debate. I'm not the most intelligent debater. I'm not, you know, I don't top my class in exams. I'm just any other student who happened to gain a platform. That's how I understand myself anyway.
Yeah. That's exactly how I feel, by the way, as well. I'm like so underqualified for this job.
That's what I thought. I'm not ready for this, but unfortunately I have to step into this kind of role, because I believe that we're in a state of political emergency, and academics, even academics like me, who I would loosely use that term for myself, must come to the forefront at this kind of
time. I completely agree. Yeah.
Well, I think that this time last year I was getting ready to lose against Farage, not knowing just yet. But sometimes these things come to you, don't they? Like, there's an obligation to put yourself forward if you believe in a certain type of society. And I just think it's like quite a noble thing, without being arrogant, I think it's quite a noble and necessary thing to do. As you said, we're in a political emergency, and people have traction with that. People recognize the problems, but sometimes kind of leaders just emerge out of circumstance, and I guess you're one of those. And
you called out in your interview with Charlie Kirk a bit of, I guess, FGM, and there was a bit of a reaction to that. Can you kind of explain a little bit about what you experienced and how people were kind of, I guess, attacking you a bit online?
So I asked him a question to kind of demonstrate that the metric of happiness, self-reported happiness surveys, is not a reliable metric.
I would ask you, would you say that a sub-Saharan African woman who's experienced female genital mutilation and checks extremely happy in a survey, and I also would check extremely happy in a survey, who do you think would be objectively more happy, even if they both check the same answer?
No, again, so I fully, if you want to talk about how Islam mistreats women, we could talk all day long. Like, I'm all for that.
Me too.
Okay, good. So we agree.
That, absolutely.
We actually
we agree
have
on many, many things.
And we should shut off Muslim immigration to the UK, right? We totally agree.
I think that all religious fundamentalism is bad. And if you take that logic, we should also not allow evangelical Christians into the UK either.
Well, hold on. So hold on a second. Hold on. That's funny. Hold on. Can you show me a single... Show me what would your example, because I have 50, of a single Christian country that you would say mistreats women, right?
America.
Oh, really?
Yes.
We had a female woman vice president. We had a female vice president, a female speaker of the house. Women earn more than men in America.
In Rwanda, female representation in government supersedes the UK by quite a lot. Do women get treated better in Rwanda?
Okay, I might be super off this. Like, is Rwanda Islamic? Like, I'm not totally sure. I don't think it is. Like, is it? Like, I don't know, actually. I don't, it's not. So
I was like, yes, fine, like, sure, like, I didn't even mention Islam. Obviously, you know, then later on in the debate, I brought up a majority Christian country, Rwanda, that is an African country.
He didn't know that it was...
And I was just sat there, like, I'm not even going to correct you at this point because, like, this has just descended into just idiocy. But essentially, I got loads of comments saying, I can't believe that you agreed with Charlie Kirk that Islam mistreats women. I can't believe you agreed with him that FGM is an invention or endorsed by Islam. But I don't think that I did that. I think what I did was point out that Islam can mistreat women, like any Abrahamic religion.
Like any religion, full stop.
Mm-hmm. Like any religion, full stop. Exactly, yeah. You know, I think this is a semantics issue. And when you're in a debate, you have to be heavily precise with your language. And I know that this might sound like nitpicky because I said, sure, I agree with you on loads of things, but it's because I'm getting a bit exasperated at this point, right? And I think when you see a very short clip of somebody speaking in a debate and they don't go out of the way to clarify something so important, which is a mistake that I made because I was thinking about time constraints, then you might assume that they have beliefs about Africa or about women or about Islam or about FGM that are misinformed or potentially misogynistic or like speak to like this white feminism.
Do you see this kind of polarization that's happening between Gen Z boys and girls? Is that something that you encounter as someone like of your cohort?
No, 100%. I think that this is like something that is really fascinating to me because I was having this debate with a friend the other day who was saying that patriarchy was kind of an inevitable thing. And I was saying, well, this is not true. Patriarchy is a bad idea that unfortunately metastasized because things like the evolution of currency coincided with it, which made it more likely to happen. And I said, the reason why I think this is true is because human beings do patriarchy way better than gorillas do it, but gorillas have way more sexual dimorphism. And I think we have to artificially create this sexual dimorphism between girls and boys under a patriarchy such that we can uphold it. And when you see a rise in like conservatism and traditional values, you also see like this complete polarization here that is in terms of aesthetics, in terms of like how we naturalize these things that are socially constructed. So one really good example of this is the more, you know how if you go to the gym and you're a man, chances are the gym influencers you follow are probably right-wing conservatives pumped full of steroids. Yeah. And if, and like, so obviously this is one extreme of masculinity. Like most men are not on trend at the gym 7 days a week. Yeah. Like balding and back acne. But like, do you know what I mean? Like, this is not most men. At the same time, most women are not confined to the home wearing like sundresses all day, baking sourdough bread in the sunlight as it like catches their beautiful locks of hair. Yeah. Like, this is total like aestheticization of sexual extremes.
Right.
So I 100% like see this polarization.
And does that have like a bad effect on how people are just like getting on? Like, does it have an effect on like relationships and stuff like that?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I saw this hilarious news article the other day about how more and more Gen Z women are trying to date millennial men because they missed the red pill manosphere stuff. So millennial men are like more normal than Gen Z men.
No way.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like if you do polling of young men, what you'll find is that they're about as conservative, especially young white men, but not always. Generally speaking, young men are as conservative as about 70-year-old men.
Really?
And as a young woman who is moving with the times and who maybe you might not even be, you know, leftist or an anti-capitalist, you might just believe that you should have the right to vote.
Yeah.
And that you shouldn't be like determined based on your biology to this role of housewife. It's really difficult, you know, for those women to date. Like, luckily, I'm in a very happy relationship, but I feel like it's like the last helicopter out of NAM. Like,
right,
that's
right.
What it feels like.
You got out of Saigon.
Yes.
that's mad. Yeah, I mean, the data that I've seen is that if you actually look at it on a graph historically, what's happened is that young women in particular have moved quite far left.
Yeah.
And then the data actually shows that men are kind of around what you would describe as the centre ground in terms of like how recorded political attitudes. Their voting patterns might be slightly different in terms of what they actually believe. But my theory is that you've got reactionary rightism amongst young guys who are responding to the fact that the common culture that we grew up in the last like 2015 to 2020 was really vocally pro-feminist, which is, I thought, was a really good thing. It was a big change. But that meant that there was a dearth and an absence of literature for young men. And so the Manosphere guys crowd into this space where they see that there are a bunch of relative issues that young men have to experience around loneliness, let's say around getting outcompeted at school, which is also another data set that's really interesting. And they activate essentially a sense of disenfranchisement.
Well, they occupy a vacuum, essentially.
And then have this nostalgic view of like when you were powerful and dominant and et cetera, et cetera, which to a teenage boy, speaking as one who was awful and, you know, disavow my teenage self, you know, you can buy into, you know, it's just like a grievance culture. If you activate my grievance and tell me I'm amazing, then I'm more likely to believe you than something another culture, which I think villainizes me. Is my theory too esoteric? Have I got something you think realistic there?
Well, I think potentially you're onto something, but maybe I would build on that. And I would say that people on the right are more likely to experience feelings of disgust, and they're more likely to be obsessed with aesthetics. So if I watch, you know, that video of that person saying, shouting, they, them, energy.
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 That, I saw that and I was like, okay. And I scrolled and it wasn't a big deal to me. It didn't destroy my worldview. But some people who experience these gut reactions to things that transgress social norms might see that video and think, this is some kind of threat to me. And I kind of feel upset by it, and I feel grossed out by it, and I can't place why. Therefore, I'm going to say that it's a natural thing and it's not created by society. I think that the reason why we are seeing so many more right-wing men nowadays is because more women are transgressing social norms. And instead of unpacking men's natural, so-called ostensibly natural reaction to these things, men are feeling disgusted and grossed out by it and deciding that this now is something to package into an ideological worldview, and that this should, and that therefore we should control how women look, appear.
And do you feel that there is a sense of responsibility as a young woman to educate these young men, or do you think that that's not for you to sort out, that's for them to figure out themselves?
I suppose I would never say to all women out there, go to Red Pill Podcast, get called a slut on television so that you can educate the men. Like, I think that is the job of political educators. That's the job of people who sign up for it, and I signed up for it. So it's my job. It's not necessarily, I'm not here to say, well, you know, all the women out there, speak to your Red Pill boyfriend and reason with him. Like, that's not what I'm here to do.
No, I think it's quite noble of you to take that mantle on and say, you know, I am going to take these people on and show them that there is an alternative. I mean, like, that's part of the reason why we do this as well. Yeah. I don't want to ever be seen to be like talking down to young men who are into this stuff, because I do worry that there's like blind spots culturally that we've had on the left about talking about their issues. But economic disenfranchisement is real across social classes, across gender, you know. And in that world, we have to actually think about the root causes more than just the kind of rhetoric value involved in, like, you know, aesthetics. And like, I think like Hassan Abi getting jacked, for instance, is like part of him trying to aesthetically appeal to these young men in a way that, in language that they find acceptable. But you know, radical leftism, I don't think, is the only way in which we should be acknowledging or doing this debate. And what is left-wing politics to you, Tilly? Like, how do you define your positions and what is left of our political institutions in the face of this democratic crisis that we find ourselves in?
My left-wing politics is probably characterised by an opposition to neoliberal policy. Out of the 1940s, like, post-war political reconfiguration of you know, like the public consciousness, what happens is we have this fear of a big state. We have a fear of fascistic control. But instead of the stereotype that neoliberalism seeks to uphold of itself, of, you know, like a small government, instead what we have is like state control that hybridizes with market control. And that creates a really dangerous atmosphere that is a deregulatory race to the bottom. I think that it's like corrosive. And I think that it causes income inequality, which is something that I'm really passionate about. I think income inequality is one of the most pressing issues, not only globally, but domestically especially, because obviously, as we've seen, between countries, income inequality has decreased, but within them, we have these absolute decimation of a strong middle-class core, which is really important for democracy. I think like my left-wing politics encompasses all of these things. I think it's like, sure, I can hark back to theory, I can hark back to materialism, whether or not I'm someone who believes that ideas drive things forward or all these other factors. But I think like in the real world, outside of debate world, outside of academics, my left-wing politics is about an opposition to that type of structure, if that makes sense.
And would you say you're a liberal broadly? Like, you believe in in that there should be some form of market mechanism. It's about reforming it. It's just not pro-neoliberalism, i.e. the system that we're currently living in.
I don't think that I would use the word liberal to describe myself.
Right.
But I did write an article on Substack. It was about what we can take from liberals. The founding fathers of liberalism actually had a lot more to say than what classical liberals give them credit for. So, for example, Adam Smith is understood as like the father of modern liberalism and the invisible hand of the market guiding all these interactions and this sort of thing. And this is why Hayek comes about. And Hayek is like the stereotype, what people believe Adam Smith is.
Can you explain what Hayek believes, just for our listeners?
Sure, yeah. Hayek believes that any kind of planned economy is automatically going to lead to some kind of totalitarian regression, and that this is obviously a bad thing. And he uses the examples of Nazi Germany as upholding itself as some kind of moral institution, not necessarily like with good morals, but as in not outside of a market mechanism, which is objective and amoral and apolitical. So Hayek says, well, in order to have a functioning democratic state, we should have a state that governs on behalf of the market only. We should have a minimal safety net below which people can't fall. And other than that, we should strip back the welfare state. We should strip back social safety mechanisms. For example, something like the NHS, he believed, would lead to authoritarian regression. So that's what Hayek believes, and that's what many people think Adam Smith believes. But this is not true. Obviously, you're nodding your head, you know this, right? Adam Smith doesn't believe this. He spoke about greed and how greed was a terrible thing, but the maxim greed is good somehow came out of Adam Smith, and this is all totally wrong. So as much as I would say I'm not a liberal, I put myself in the leftist camp if I were to do something like that and assign myself this. But I'm young, I'm 20 years old, I think. Yeah. I have a lot to learn. Maybe it's a little arrogant of me to place myself somewhere so early. But if I had to do it, that's where I'd put myself.
One of the greatest bits of literature, I think, is The Theory of Moral Sentiments by Adam Smith. I mean, everyone defers to The Wealth of Nations, which is just, which is where they get the invisible hand and the free market and all that kind of stuff. But there's a whole kind of moral philosophy that encompasses kind of Smithsonian thinking, again, with some of the great liberals of John Stuart Mill, Rousseau, Rawls, all these people. And yet they have been hijacked by like a right wing ideological caucus in the Hayekian school of thinking that has now come to dominate society. And I think it's a perversion to the traditions of like Enlightenment, right-wing liberal kind of thinking that has now like co-opted our institutions, that has ensured that governments can't respond to the issues of the day because they're so constrained by market interests. And I think, I mean, I would entirely agree with you what you said. I mean, I would put myself in a socialist camp more so than a liberal camp, but you didn't ask me the question.
No. I asked because I'm still kind of agnostic about a lot of this stuff. I guess the real interest of what you were making the point about greed is that the way in which people can see this now is just the presence of monopolies.
Yeah.
And people like Peter Thiel who think that monopolies are good, right? Like this is how the market should be structured, is that you just have to corner a bit and own it. And if you're not working that way around, you're doomed to fail.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think about the way in which American capitalism has moved so far and is moving under Trump?
Yeah, I think, well, the reason why I'm so interested in the United States is because it has a consequence for all of us.
Yeah.
I don't think that the reason why, obviously, harking back to that speech I made at the Union a long time ago, welcoming the decline of America, obviously, I don't think America should burn.
You've got the
ground.
USA top on.
I do. It's part of the brand at this point. It's part
of the brand. Your mouse, Ralph.
There's some far right guy just like punching the air, like with every comment you make.
Yeah. What was I saying?
You're saying about the decline of America.
Yeah, I was saying I don't want America to burn to the ground. I would just prefer a multipolar world order where there is a more egalitarian structure of, like, international hierarchy. In terms of the way that monopolies have, like, conducted themselves over the past few decades, I mean, even some of the founding fathers themselves would have worried about it. I can't remember his name. But one of the, people who can like kind of help conceive the Constitution, he even began to worry as the, like following the birth of America as a very young country about the largesses of corporate control. And so I wonder what these people would have to say now when we see like corporatism and financialization invade every aspect of public and private life in the United States.
I think Luigi Mangione is when you have corporatism on steroids, monopolization of new industries, people feeling that there's going to be a decimation of, which you're already seeing, right? Like the big beautiful bills just come out.
Yeah.
A load of public services have had their money completely cut. Trump's specifically gone after healthcare as well. I think what's really fascinating is that to me, that is capitalist, anti-capitalist terrorism. And the way in which, I'm not a supporter, I'm not an endorser before anyone comes after me.
We condemn.
I'm not pro assassinating anyone, for the record. And, you know, there's a reason why I think, interestingly, the debate about him in the mainstream media is just so shut off. I mean, if this was terrorism of any other kind, you would be we speak about Islamist terrorism constantly. It's an awful evil. It's a problem.
To be condemned.
Mm-hmm. It's an awful, which is condemned, which we condemn, But we're not talking about it in the same vein. I just think that's so fascinating about where debate can really be, you know, held to the limelight and places where it can't be.
Yeah.
We're moving in an incredibly dangerous way. And I think you're right in to say that America is the center of gravity and we're all downstream of what happens there. How does the UK, you know, fit itself into that world? And I think, would you say you are someone who is still like a Labour supporter?
I mean, it's a contentious question, isn't it? Because it's a miracle that even a centre-right party has won an election in the UK. And the only reason why this has happened was because of the state of the Conservative Party. They were in shambles. Yes, I support the Labour Party. I think that, I mean, during Starmer's first few weeks, there were like 32 new draft laws. I think he's speaking on it. I think he's trying to renationalise the railways. I'm not so updated on that.
It's happening.
Yeah. Like, I think these are good things. At the same time, I just obviously condemn, he made this speech.
The Island of Strangers one.
The Island of Strangers speech.
He said he regrets that now.
I'm sure he does regret it. Yeah. I don't know what's going on with his management, his PR.
The comms have been really bad.
Bad comms.
And people don't know what the mission is. The reason why I asked if you're a Labour supporter is because there's an impact and an influence that US politics, I think, are having on our country. And people who are in politics know that what happens there has a knock-on consequence for what happens here. And so left-wing politics finds itself in this really awful bind between a world where the populists are setting the agenda in America and we are still trying to decide what our political program is to rival it.
Yeah.
And how do we, not only rival it, but how do we respond to the fact that it's happening to what is meant to be our closest ally? I don't think the left, as we understand it, has a way of navigating that, because there's still such an attachment to an Atlanticist world order that I think there is still some hesitation about calling it what it is, which is, to me, a form of democratic authoritarianism.
I 100% agree. It's like, to what extent can we continue to abide by our understanding of a special relationship if America's continuing to ascend towards fascism? And how is that going to compromise our morality if, you know, a state can be immoral, like have a moral framework.
Do what it's doing in Israel, like sponsor all of that.
Exactly,
I completely agree with you. And it's trying to explain this to my friends who are of the left but feel like they have to abandon the Labour Party because of this moral quandary that we find ourselves in. You know, it takes so long to like put everything, you know, all of these premises in place, justify them to that person so that they accept that that's where we find ourselves. But if we don't have that literacy, we're never going to be able to make sense of it. And I think the big problem really is that whilst we're trying to rival populism, while we're trying to find out some solution, political project that's meant to be the antithesis that people can buy into, we're not necessarily always acknowledging what even the conditions that even made populism arise in the first place. And so that's where, like, the immigration stuff, for instance, we get in a muddle, because some people want to say a world without borders, whilst other people are saying that actually this is completely new, this level of immigration, and it's having an effect on our culture and our society.
But I would say it's kind of intellectual ignorance, because the answers have long existed and they've been kind of developed throughout the last 25 years in this country and around the world. It's a point-blank refusal to engage with them, to accept them as legitimate bodies of thinking, and to a point incorporate them as part of your political movement.
Exactly. I mean, when you watch older debates that happen in Parliament, something that really interests me is that the word socialism is used all the time, and it's debated as a legitimate economic idea, because it is a legitimate economic idea. Margaret Thatcher was not shying away from calling out what she perceived as the ills of socialism and a nanny state and all the other, you know, everything else. And nowadays, we don't see this kind of debate about what kind of economic model do we want. We had the debate in post-war Britain about whether or not we should continue to adopt Keynesianism, about whether or not euro-dollar markets were necessarily a good thing, about whether or not we should follow America's footsteps in that way, or whether and kind of take on this transatlantic deregulatory feedback loop. That's what the literature sort of calls it. We were having these debates, these broad sweeping intellectual debates, and they were happening in the public sphere, and it was vibrant, and people were involved. Postmen, you know, cleaners, there was a much more vibrant political space.
Yeah, and now we just talk about trans.
Now we talk about should transgender women be allowed in sports?
Yeah.
Muslims and communism.
Yeah. Yeah, are Muslims communists? Like, all this like, nonsense.
Just ridiculous.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's, like the, it's a dilution
just,
of...
We're just completely distracted.
Yeah, it's a total dilution of politics. And I wish that we would return back to an environment where we could speak about the legitimacy of all different kinds of economic ideas, which is why, you know, I think it's silly that people say leftists are pro-censorship, because I'm not pro-censorship at all. I think more things have legitimacy than the right gives them credit for.
The Labour Party, I mean, that's why I'm a member and why I love the Labour Party. It's been a vibrant intellectual movement in this country for 125 years. First 40 years was a real kind of theoretical comprehension as to the state of Britain and what aspirations we want for the country and for the majority of people who went to work and lived on a wage. There is such a dearth of that conversation, and I think it's subsequent of a decline in the union movement and kind of other things, a changing kind of labour force. But we have to ask ourselves and interrogate, what does a social democracy look like for the next 70 years? It can't just be tepid reform of already what we have. The Labour Party's conceding in what I think is its historical, political and intellectual 100%. Obligation in advocating for the many people in our society who basically keep the country going.
I do think that Labour has taken on a new image and in doing so failed its working class constituents, which makes up the, you know, majority. Do working class people make up the majority of Labour supporters now? I'm not fully up to date on
it's hard. It depends how you define working class.
That's right? True.
And then also, like, you know, Reform's new base, you describe them as working class, right? So in some sense, Labour has failed its working class constituents because they don't represent a type of conservative social politics that is still alive and well in areas that were deindustrialized. You know, areas that you grew up. Yeah. I'm sure you know many, many people who are fans of Reform because they speak in a language that they recognize.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why my parents moved away from St. Helens, because it was becoming, even back then, they describe it as becoming like a white supremacist town.
Really?
And obviously, I mean, now I can't imagine what it's like. I have a cousin who I speak to from St. Helens, and he tells me that his family, you know, are playing white power songs and speaking and voting for Reform. And this is normal and commonplace.
What's a white power song?
White power song?
Like what, like Kanye West? The new Kanye album. Is that, I guess that kind of counts.
Well, yeah, I don't know if they're playing that. Maybe the younger ones. But, you know, like KKK songs, this is something...
That's fucking mental.
Yeah.
But again, that's the weakness of the Labour movement, to create a positive case for people.
Yes.
So people are defaulting to what I see to be quite toxic and anti-British cultures and values, because for so long, outside of trying to get into government, we just haven't made the case for what we believe in, this type of society we want to create. Mm-hmm. And that's really concerning to me that's happening.
Yeah, 100%.
But it scarily doesn't surprise me either.
Definitely. But like, to clarify, I do believe that racism comes from top down. It's something where, you know, it's not this bottom-up movement. Mm-hmm. It rarely is a bottom-up movement. Like, maybe Poland is an exception. Like, you can think of these individualized exceptions where racism and like hyper-nationalistic sentiment is something that comes from the bottom-up. But most of the time, I would argue that consent for policies that actually go against the best interests of working-class people is procured, like, by good intelligent policymakers, that is then spoken into existence in the pub and at social gatherings and finally at the ballot box.
They've announced that there's going to be a new left-wing party. So Zara Sultana and Jeremy Corbyn are coming together. Do you think that this is going to be a positive for the wider left-wing movement, or do you think that this could be a negative?
Well, on the one hand, it's a means by which to hold the Labour Party accountable. On the other hand, this has come about at a time when I believe that the Reform Party is a serious threat to democracy in the United Kingdom. What I worry about is that as much as I think Jeremy Corbyn, like, I align myself strongly with most of Jeremy Corbyn's politics. I met him when I was 11, when he was going around the election. I got a picture with him. Like, I worry of him, that him being the face of that party is going to backfire because of the way that the media treated him. Because, I mean, there was that awful picture of him in a hat because it was cold, and they put these, like, Soviet-style propaganda... It was on the BBC. I mean, the way that this that the media onslaught against Jeremy Corbyn occurred, I don't know if that's that he's able to recover from it, and I hope that he can. But at the same time, obviously, there's that worry that there's going to be division among the left. And I hope that instead of causing further division, the current Labour Party stops capitulating to the interests of the right and instead listens to what everyone...
But I guess that's the argument that the Labour Party would put forward, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Like, you're splintering the progressive vote and you're going to get a Reform MP as a consequence.
And I hear it. I 100% hear it. And I don't have a solution. I'm not here to make prescriptions. Like, my kind of... What I see myself as, in terms of my role in politics, is someone to just speak about what the problems are, what the data looks like in political science, what the literature is saying. It's up to policymakers and it's up to more informed people than a political science students to be making prescriptions for people.
I think I'm hearing a torn heart on your between someone who acknowledges that, like, there is a moral basis for where these people's politics is coming from, but there is a pragmatic problem in splintering the party. And that's where I'm always going to lean to the practical, because it's real rather than the that's ideological. Do, that's my politics. But I think the problem that we're landing on is that the left are increasingly divided again. You know, we're increasingly splintered again. Mm-hmm. And that the only way in which you go, you know, we could keep Reform out with a cordon sanitaire in the same way that, like, French politics managed to keep out Marine Le Pen and the Front National now. But if they can't find a prescription, like a political project to unite that front, you're just putting off the inevitable. Exactly. And so we've got to unite the left. We've got to, like, figure out there's a space in the tent big enough that can account for these people.
Yeah, of course. And I think, to me, that's where some of my concern comes, is that people are feeling as though they're being pushed out. I'm always a defender in the broad church. I think it should have everybody who is left of centre thought, because that is the makeup of British society. I mean, there are going to be people who vote for Labour because they don't want the Tories, and they're going to be people who are to the left and have an ideological vision as to what they want. They are all legitimate voters in a democracy. Mm-hmm. To me, this is a real conversation now about how does the Labour Party respond to people leaving, or a voter base that is increasingly declining because of its kind of politics. What does it do about that, less so being bothered about kind of Corbyn and Zara Sultana saying up their own thing?
And I think one of the main reasons why we see this... this type of quandary is because nowadays politics is only exercised at the ballot box, whereas previously we could do politics in loads of other ways. So now we see the emergence of left-wing parties that do, in all honesty, splinter the left-wing vote. But that's because politics has been, like, gutted from public life everywhere else. So we have to engage in it only at the ballot box. Mm-hmm. And our vote is the only way in which we can conceivably understand ourselves to be participating in politics. I think that needs to change.
And I think one of the kind of potential failures of this new project is that they don't have a base of support. So they're just MPs advocating for a particular vision in Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't build kind of coalitions with trade unionists. They didn't build coalitions with kind of activists and members on the ground before launching this party. The infrastructure that I suspect any new political party would need in order to win any election. Rather, they were kind of protesting about the direction of the Labour Party and saying, well, fine, we're going to go and set up our own thing over here, rather than seeking to soothe maybe some of the poverty around intellectualism and kind of vibrancy of the Labour Party more broadly. Yeah. That's what's going to be the problem, I think, for them. I will always support the Labour Party, but I think it has to be more accommodating of people who may be a bit more challenging of the current direction of it.
Do you know what I think? Fuck factionalism. I'm so dead. Like, I'm so bored of factionalism. Mm. Like, can't we just realise that, like, we're in a moment of sliding doors between something really, really bad and something that could be a bit better? And that ideological solutions, full stop, are not the answer. Like, you have to be... Everyone has got to acknowledge that they're fallible, that they can be wrong. Mm-hmm. There's blind... We've all got blind spots. And yet, we have these historic reasons why we, like, you know, we got in beef at student politics in, like, 2019. Do you know what I mean? Get over it. Yeah, like, get over it, because if not, they will capitalise.
Yeah, of course.
And they've got the the 1%, the massive wealth vehicle behind them to be able to trial all the new ways of campaigning, of, you know,
communication,
of brainwashing there is. Like, we have to be so much more humble about our politics than we currently are.
Strange enough, I've kind of come around to this view that on the back of my membership card, it says it's a Democratic Socialist Party. I identify as a Democratic Socialist. I think for so long we've almost focused on the socialist part and interrogated what it means to be a socialist in modern society. Whereas today, now, we are, following our conversation, in the days of eroding democracy. The fight back is against oligarchy and authoritarianism and oligopoly and all these things. Until the left unites around the kind of presupposition of the democracy part of the back of my membership card, then we can go and kind of advocate for the socialism. There are kind of almost bigger threats which could supersede our efforts in trying to achieve socialism or social democracy. And that we're just kind of, as you say, splintering because we've focused on one bit of the membership card, which is deeply ideological and at times painful to kind of confront against the thing that we all subscribe to, which is democracy in the face of such hostile political activity.
Yes, 100% agree. Well, nothing more to add to that.
Perfect. Well, then I think we can wrap on that note. We're trying to start a fucking movement. Do you know what I mean? I think people like us need to be just getting more and more and more people involved to talk about these problems. If you're interested in joining the journey for us figuring out what is left, please subscribe, drop us a like, drop us a follow on IG. We might even get on a live one day.
Yeah, exactly.
Bro, we've got big plans. So please join us as we figure out what's left.
What's left.